Good afternoon and welcome to the Thursday afternoon session of our program on nutrition here at this global conference. We welcome you to this. And as we begin, I would like to just make an announcement. In your materials that you've got in your packet, there is this little promotional piece regarding a new cookbook. At Loma Linda University, we are celebrating two 100th anniversaries. We have just gotten through celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Nutrition and Dietetics Program at Loma Linda. And in October, we will begin a year-long celebration of the School of Medicine, their 100th anniversary of beginning. So School of Nursing and School of Nutrition and Dietetics are kind of the older siblings of the School of Medicine. And so we're going to kind of rub it into them during this next year, and I think we'll have a good time. But the point that I wanted to make is that I do have a copy of the cookbook if you would like to take a look at it. This is not available for you to take away, but you can at least take a look at it if you have any desire to do so. This afternoon, we're going to be talking about the science of small gardens. Now, in times of economic adversity, as we are dealing with today, the popularity and necessity of a small garden seems to increase. On the other hand, there are those who have consistently planted a garden. Whether it was here in Switzerland or in Germany, that was their livelihood. That's what they ate throughout the year. So we're specifically talking about those that have not planted a garden or have just played around with the concept of a garden. Now, the benefits of having a small garden not only include the fresh vegetables and fruits and berries that we harvest each year, but also the benefits of rest or change of pace that we get, the sunshine, the fresh air, exercise, socialization, that comes about with the interchange that we have of exchanging fruits and produce that we have produced in a garden. Now, this does not imply that gardening is easy or even idyllic, but it is a relaxing process that can be a real benefit for us in our lives. The picture comes to mind of a garden space located in a village in Romania, or in the yard of a home in Kenya, or a vacant space within a city of Chengdu, China, or any other city or village or farm that you want to think about. You'll often find these gardens. But can we find a garden in your home? Maybe that's something that we need to really spend some time on. In Switzerland, or in Germany, or in other European countries, I really enjoy looking at the gardens. I spent a good bit of time on Sunday of this week looking at gardens in Muren, up in the Alps. Beautiful. But I have seen them in Berlin. I have seen them in other cities as well. It has a small summer house in which you can rest and even prepare a meal with the vegetables and fruits that you have harvested in this pleasing environment. So I would encourage you, as you travel about in Switzerland and other parts of Europe or in your home country, look for these delightful garden locations and try to duplicate it in your home. Now, the economic advantage of a small garden includes the vegetables and fruit that you eat, but also any excess that you have that you can take to market. Surplus produce could be available for sale, or you can use it in bartering, or you can dry it or otherwise store it for use during the cold or non-growing seasons of the garden. Home gardening can enable a family or a community to live better with increased health and well-being. To make a difference in this world, we can modify a famous phrase, so rather than giving food to a child, we will teach the child and the family how to grow a garden and to be able to eat well for a lifetime. Here we're talking about a serious effort to grow food and to provide nourishment for the family in every space, every plot, every container that is available to that family. Now that the possibility of a garden exists, there comes to mind a number of questions. The first question is, what science, knowledge, equipment, supplies do I need to be a successful gardener? Is this going to cost more than the value of the fruits and vegetables that I grow? It's a concern of many. You know, are they going to spend so much money on the materials that they don't really benefit? But if you invest in high quality tools that will last you a lifetime, I think that is a good economic decision. The second question that I think that we need to deal with is, what foods can I grow that are the most nutritious? And so we're going to use this term or this question as a decision criterion that we will look at throughout this presentation. The third question is, how much space do I need to make an economic difference in our household budget? And finally, how much of each vegetable do I need to plant? I don't know, I have sometimes started a garden, but I have gone into it with not a lot of planning. And I think that is where I have failed in the past. I need to be a much better planner and knowing what I'm going to plant, how much, and how much space it's going to take me to grow the products that I want. Now, one of the biggest issues that I think that we have is that of soil science. There is a very famous Seventh-day Adventist gardener by the name of Jacob Mittleider. Have any of you heard of him? Jacob Mittleider actually lived in Loma Linda, but he traveled the world, working particularly in the South Seas and in Eastern Europe, in helping small Seventh-day Adventist schools to develop farms and gardens that would support the students in that school. And he developed fantastic results. And so I highly recommend his methods to you. And in the paper that I have written, I have given you a website that will take you to the Mittleider method. And so I'm extracting some of the material from that I think will be helpful. And so the basic premise that he is operating under, that is Mr. Mittleider, is that you've got to have good soil in order to grow good food. And so the foundation of our vegetable garden is going to be the soil that contains the nutrients necessary to support the growth of healthy plants. The development of topsoil is a critical process in a productive garden. The addition of organic materials, such as from a compost pile or from other decaying organic materials, is one of the areas, one of the amendments that could be added to the soil. Or we might include such things as peat moss that can also bring additional organic materials into the garden. But what we need to have in this topsoil are minerals and other residual rock fragments that are going to provide the basic minerals that are necessary. Number two is the organic matter, the decomposed remains of plants and or animals. Number three, microorganisms like bacteria or fungi or mold, algae, nematodes. These are going to be helpful in breaking down this organic material and making it available to increase the quality of the soil. We also need air in this soil mixture, moisture, and plant food. So supporting the top soil is a subsoil which is made up of coarser materials, larger rocks, clay, and what this has to do is help to drain water from the roots, which is necessary for healthy root growth. Now, minerals in our body are essential for our growth and development. Just so in plants, minerals are absolutely necessary for the metabolic functions that are occurring in the plant. Minerals are present in the soil, or they may need to be added through some way. Now, the organic matter is important to provide texture for the topsoil, but the systematic addition of amendments, particularly as we look at the minerals, is going to be critical for the success of our garden. The environmental nutrients that are needed include carbon dioxide. If you know the photosynthesis system, the basic input is carbon dioxide. It is absorbed through the leaves, and the waste product of photosynthesis is oxygen. The next one, and probably the most important, is nitrogen. This is the limiting nutrient in crop yields. Plant roots take up nitrogen from ammonium and nitrates in the soil and convert it to nitrites. This is the form in which nitrogen then enters the plant through the roots. Nitrogen imparts a deep green color to the leaves and encourages above-ground vegetative growth. In organic matter, nature stores nitrogen in forms slowly available to the plants, but only in relatively small amounts. Organic material is broken down by organisms, and these microorganisms require nitrogen for this process. And if the organisms cannot get enough nitrogen from the organic material, it will get it from the soil, which it will be robbing the roots of the nitrogen, whatever nitrogen is available. Any organic material that contains at least 1.5% nitrogen has just enough nitrogen to take care of its own decomposition. So the amount of nitrogen has to be greater than 1.5% in order for it to be used within the plant system. Nitrogen is also lost through leaching action from rainfall, irrigation, and the soil organisms, as we were talking about. And so as a result, nitrogen must be added at least 2 times a year. The next mineral is phosphorus. Phosphorus is necessary for the process of photosynthesis, and it provides a process by which energy is transferred within a plant. The next one is potassium. Plants remove more potassium from the soil than any other nutrient except for nitrogen and calcium. Potassium exists in the soil in several chemical forms. Some are very soluble and available for plant use. Other forms are insoluble even with the strongest acids. Potassium is essential to the life processes of a plant, including manufacturing and movement of sugars and starch, and normal growth by cell division. Calcium now is also a macronutrient and is highly essential. It plays a fundamental role in cell manufacture and growth. Most roots use calcium at the growing tip of the root. The last of the macronutrients is magnesium, and this is one element that is in the chlorophyll molecule. And so without magnesium, we have pretty well established that the photosynthesis system is not going to work successfully. Now we're going to turn our attention to some trace nutrients, such as sulfur. Sulfur acts with nitrogen in making new protoplasm for plant cells. So sulfur plus nitrogen is going to yield that essential element for growth. Iron is also another trace element and is essential for chlorophyll formation. And you may have seen plants that turn yellow. This is an indication that there is not enough iron in the soil. Manganese is another. It is also necessary for photosynthesis, nitrogen metabolism, and to form other compounds for plant metabolism. Zinc, another trace element, is necessary for normal growth of all plants. It functions as a catalyst in the utilization of nutrients. A symptom of zinc deficiency is yellow coloration between the veins of a leaf. Copper is another trace element and is necessary for carbohydrate and nitrogen metabolism. And one of the evidences of not enough copper in the soil is the stunting of the growth of the plant. Molybdenum is another. It is involved in enzyme systems relating to nitrogen fixation in the soil. One of the more important trace elements is boron. I used to grow tomatoes, and the soil that I grew them in did not have enough boron. And what happened was that the flowers, as they were formed, would just drop off. And that is a symptom of boron deficiency. Add boron to the soil, and you get strong formation of the fruiting process. Finally, chlorine is the other element that we need to talk about, and it really has to do with the modification of the electrical charges and balancing these electrical charges in the physiological functions in plants. Now, there are many individuals who choose not to use an organic fertilizer or any other commercial fertilizer because they would like to make sure that they are using or producing an organic garden. And what they do is depend upon manure, which is high in nitrogen, but not necessarily the other minerals that we have talked about, which are necessary for plant growth. So, as we have seen, the ratio of these nutrients is important in order to provide for optimum growth within the plant itself. Fertilizers come in a balanced formula. So it may be necessary that you do a soil analysis in order to avoid burning of the plant with too much nutrition. Now, the other question that we were faced with is, what foods do I grow? The best choice would include the most nutritious vegetables. One measure of nutrient content is the antioxidant power of the fruit or vegetables. And so the fruits and vegetables that we're going to be looking at this afternoon are high in antioxidants, just as Dr. Craig was talking with us about yesterday afternoon. So I'm going to turn to Chef Corey to talk a little bit about the vegetables that he has just harvested from his garden.
Yes, and brought with me. Okay, I'm going to put on this little microphone here, so hold on with me for just a sec. Well, that was pretty painless. Okay. I just have one question real quick. How many people in this room have a garden at their house and use the vegetables out of it? Fantastic. Quite a few of you. That's great. As a chef, I work, obviously, with vegetables as my career. They're important to me. They help me make a living. So they're very important in what I do. And most of what I get for the restaurants comes to me commercially. But there's a trend in restaurants right now that most of us chefs are planting herb gardens on the property wherever we're working so that at least we have fresh herbs available to us. But I would love to see it where more restaurants and other institutions were using produce right out of gardens that they had on their property. It tends to be much better produce, better quality, better nutrient value. And when you're growing it yourself, you value it more. So there's less waste, and you use it in more creative ways. So I have a garden at my house that I have been taking good care of, but I bet that I need to modify the minerals in the soil because it's not producing as much as it should. But let's take a look at some of the products that you could potentially have in your own gardens and why you might want to do that. The first one we're going to look at is green leafy vegetables. And this one's very important in all, especially for vegetarians, to have in gardens. And the group of green leafy vegetables is a very huge group. Just the small list that we have here, kale, chard, collard greens, spinach, parsley, you've got mustard greens. There's just a huge variety of things in that category to look at. Here we have green leaf lettuce, a nice big head of green leaf lettuce, and the greens that are on these carrots, which we don't usually use. They're a pretty strong flavor. But what can you do with them? If you have a really hearty green, like kale or collard greens, if you want to use it raw, you can. I know most people don't. But if you chop it up very thin or in small pieces, it is a lot easier to eat. So you don't get that huge mouthful of a really harsh green that you have to chew and chew and chew and chew and chew. So a cut of a chiffonade, which is very thin, works very well for those. If you want to cook them, I know a lot of people will cook something like a collard green or a Swiss chard, and they'll cook it for a long time because they feel like they need to have that cooking time to soften it enough to eat it. And that's a misconception. You really don't need to cook it very long. But what you do need to do is you need to strip the stem off of it. And if you grab the leaf, I wish I had some hearty green leaves here, but I don't. So I'm just going to use this lettuce and show you. If you hold the leaf with the stem part in one hand and just wrap your fingers around the stem and pull, you can pull that stem right off of the leaf, and then you have the nice, easy-to-cook rest of the leaf. Obviously, I wouldn't do that with nice, soft lettuce like this, but with a kale or Swiss chard, that works really well. This is just green leaf lettuce. Green leaf lettuce. And it's a very soft leaf, so you really don't have to worry about the stem on this one. But then what I would do is take that stem and chop it up into very small pieces and sauté it so that it has a little more cooking time than the rest of the leaf. Then I would take the softer part of the leaf and I would chop it up in big pieces, add it to the pan that I've sautéed the other stuff in, put a lid on it, let it steam for about 5 minutes, season it with salt and pepper, and you have a nice dish there. Very easy to cook that way. Other types of greens like spinach you can use very easily fresh in salads, or you could use it in a soup. Green leafy vegetables do very well in soups. Broccoli. Broccoli is really great steamed, used in soup. With a green vegetable like broccoli, there's one thing you have to remember. Don't overcook it. Right? If you cook it and let it set, the chlorophyll is destroyed, which gives you that drab green color. So if you cook it and eat it right away, you're fine. Or if you cook it and then chill it really well, and then you can bring it back up to a warm temperature and it holds on to that green color. All right? The green color is really what you're looking for, because most people associate bright colors with nutrients. So they think that that's a more nutritious vegetable. Not to mention, it just looks better. It's more appetizing. Right? I know a lot of chefs that will take a vegetable peeler and peel the stem so that it doesn't have that harsh skin on the outside. That's a lot of fiber, and if you don't need that much fiber in your diet, that's great. Strip that off. Cooks much faster and is a lot more pleasant to eat. Brussels sprouts, another very green vegetable. This one, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, things like cauliflowers, they have sulfur in the cells, and if you cook them too long, you'll break the cells open and release that sulfur. So again, with these vegetables, you want to keep the cooking time short. Red and green peppers are wonderful eaten fresh, like these. Cut a piece off, use it as a chip or something for dips, really good that way. Roast it, pull the skin off, really develops the flavor. Garlic and onions are used as a base of flavor in a lot of dishes. They can be eaten raw, roasted, steamed, any other way. Sweet potatoes are one of the most nutritious vegetables that you can eat. Usually steamed, and then you peel the skin off and eat it straight. Or you can cut it up and sauté it with a little bit of butter or olive oil. That's a good way to do it too. Tomatoes, kind of a cross between a fruit and a vegetable, depending on who you're talking to. Tomatoes are used a lot in cooking. They're a base of many sauces. We use them raw. We use them cooked. We use them concentrated. We use them in many different ways. Green peas are best lightly steamed and tossed into a salad or with pasta. If you can, always buy your peas fresh. Frozen peas tend to lose a little bit of their consistency, and they're just not as fun to eat. Carrots, everybody's familiar with carrots. Peel them or don't peel them as you like. I like to take a green scrub pad, just a rough towel, and wipe off the outside under running water, and that's enough for those. Okay, those are some of the vegetables that we suggest for your garden because they're highly nutritious. But
30 seconds.
To finish?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. we have two terms up here, heirloom and heritage. These are interchangeable terms that we use for food products that have a history in their genome, so they haven't been altered in any way. These would be natural products that you would find in the wild. We're moving back to utilizing those types of things versus hybrids and genetically modified things, which we've seen a lot of in the recent past.
Thank you.
Is that enough?
I want you to rest assured that all of this material will be on the website with the PowerPoint, with the complete article. There's one whole section that we've left out in terms of how much do you need to plant in order to eat. That is in the entire paper that you will see. But one or two words in conclusion. Your success is going to depend upon your knowledge, your skills, and I think that we have developed some of that for you this afternoon. But determination. Do you have the determination to be successful in gardening? Knowledge begins with an understanding of soils. A healthy plant that grows in that soil is going to be better able to resist disease, insects, and weeds. The minerals that we've talked about are essential for the growth of that plant. And if we're going to talk about the nutrition for us as humans, we need to make certain that we are growing foods that are high in nutrient content. I think now the only thing left is determination. How's your garden going to grow? Success to you. Thank you very much.
This is where we left off, I believe, right? Yes, we were talking about heirloom seeds and heritage seeds. And I mentioned that these two terms are used interchangeably a lot today, and we refer to these as the... these varieties of seeds are the originals. Before humans started tampering with things, doing hybridization and genome modification, these seeds were in existence. And we have seen a huge drive to get back to the heirloom varieties with things like tomatoes especially and beans. And this gives a little more information about heirlooms being open-pollinated plant varieties. Hybrids, we have had hybrids in our food supply for hundreds of years. It has been something that humans learned to do quite early and have been doing a lot of ever since, and it actually does happen to some extent naturally. So that's how we get the variety of foods that we have in the world today. But a lot of people look at hybridization as just another modification of the foods that we're eating, and so there's a question of whether we should be eating those or not. Heirloom and heritage is looked at as being stuff that was available before, say, 50 years ago, when hybridization really started to take off and science grew to the point where we could start making adjustments to things. There are definitely advantages to using heirloom seeds. They have resistance to some diseases and bugs that are not so in modern varieties of seeds. We've found seeds in Aztec tombs, and we've found seeds in Egyptian tombs, and they're still viable even after all those years. So those are some great examples of traditional and heirloom things. That's all I have for that. Yeah. What do I think about genetically modified organisms? That is a hugely debated topic, and I do not have all of the information on that, so I'm probably not the best person to ask. But my personal opinion and my professional opinion as a chef, I think that those things have a place in the world today, but I think that there is still a lot of research that needs to go on with them to determine how safe they truly are.
I just want to add on that, the genetically modified foods, plants, vegetables, we have crossbred. We have been doing crossbreeding for a long time, and that is essentially genetic modification from one pure gene of one plant to another gene. So sometimes I see genetically modified organism or GMO or those terms that goes along that line is just that starting off whatever year that term comes out is somebody is really smart that came up with a term, but we have done genetic modification for a long time. It's not true, and we have to be careful in thinking about that, and sometimes that is just the way their genetic modification companies is trying to make them survive. Say, like, you know, you have to go back to them to buy the seeds all the time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It's not true, and like I said, genetically modified, you know, there's a lot of crossbreeding right now, or if you may call it genetic modification, and it's going to come out a lot more, it's going to continually come out to whatever extent it's going to be. So we just have to watch out in the future and see how things develop. But in terms of the safety or not, it is safe. And the term, I suggest that we think about it, use our judgment, and just think about what we have done in the past for many, many years.
It should also be noted that the genetic modification is being driven by consumers. We're the ones who want to have red ripe tomatoes that sit on our shelf for 2 weeks without going bad, and we're the ones that want to have other things that are designed into our food so that they look good on shelves and that they last. So, I mean, it's a big question of who do we go to make these modifications and should we be doing it, and still a lot of questions that are being asked about it.
I just want to add with that, too, since I have a nutrition background and a food science background, this is kind of a side, but I have to say it because I have to both backgrounds. With the obesity that is rising and, you know, with that epidemic, a lot of people are blaming the food industry. But what Chef Corey just said, that is an example that instead of blaming the food industries, instead of blaming the food technologies, people that know nutrition should work together with the food technologies, because the food technologists, the food scientists, are the one that knows how to make the food that the nutritionists or the people that knows nutrition, what they want. What is the people with nutrition background know what's supposed to be eaten or what's good or what's not good. The food scientist is the one that knows how to make it.
Well, actually that depends on who is labeling it as organic. There are a lot of different societies and organizations that people, farmers, can go to get their products labeled, and they all have different criteria by which to label them. So, unfortunately, governments, the United States just recently passed legislation determining what labeling of organic biodynamic and other things actually means, but there are a lot of agencies and organizations in the United States that think that they didn't go far enough, and their requirements for labeling organic far exceed the United States government. So it's, if you see a product that has an organic label on it, you should ask who is certifying it and what are their standards. That's the only way, unfortunately, right now, that you will really know. As you can see, this is a hugely debated topic, and there are a lot of there's a lot of controversy about it, and everyone has an opinion. And I think that it deserves a lot more discussion, but this forum right now probably isn't the place for it. And we actually do have some more to discuss about gardens, so I'll let Dr. Connell finish up.
And I think that's one of the reasons that we talked about the heritage seeds, because if you are concerned about genetic modification, these heritage seeds do not have that. Excuse me. And you can provide food for you and your family that do not have those issues. Just one or two comments that I'd like to make in conclusion. And that is, as we look at the Mittleider method, one of the elements that we need to talk about is the fact that the plants are that they are planted in a raised bed. They may be from 6 to 8 inches in depth, and this is where your topsoil is, and so this is where you're going to put the emphasis in terms of building up your soil with the organic materials that you have from your compost pile, from other sources that you have. And so it is within these raised beds that you're going to be planting your seeds and your plants that you have started. The typical design of these boxes is about 3 meters by 5 meters. That's the total amount of space that would provide food for a family of four for a growing season. But if we were to look at 1/10 of a hectare of land, we could put 60 raised boxes that are 30 meters long and about 3 meters wide. And in these boxes, what can we grow? If we have these rows of boxes, we can have 5 plants of tomatoes, 4 zucchini squash, 6 green peppers or red peppers, cabbage to your desire, bush beans, peas, lettuce, either leaf or bib lettuce, beets, carrots, chard, and radishes. Now, one of the things that I think we need to remember as we're planting, we've talked about the management of planting. What is the length of the growing season, and what is the length of time between germination and harvesting of the product? And many times you can get 2, 3, or 4 harvests from the same amount of space. And so even though you have a very limited space, you can produce over the growing season a significant amount of food product. And this is what I was talking about in just a moment ago. But if we were looking, and I'm just going to use this slide and let you look at the other material that will be made available to you, that if we were using these 10-meter long soil beds, we're going to be able to produce a significant amount of food, 2,300 kilograms of tomatoes, for example. 4 beds of sweet peppers should produce between 1,000 and 2,000 peppers. And so this is going to be plenty of peppers, but this is more of a school situation, or where you're going to be producing food not only for yourself but for the community. And that's something that I think that we really need to look at. Thank you so much for staying by. Look at the materials that will be available on the website that has been put on the screen. And success to you as you are providing nutritious food for you and your family. Let your garden grow. Thank you.